Have you ever got a maths book as a Christmas present? Me neither. But 2025 could be the year where that changes and you still have a happy Christmas, thanks to our next guest. Noah Jansiracusa is Associate Professor in Mathematical Sciences at Bentley University, and he's developed what seems like more than a side hustle in writing books about maths and, in particular, algorithms. In 2021, he published his first book, How Algorithms Create and Prevent Fake News. And Noah's latest is called Robin Hood Math. It's out in Australia and offers insights into how to, quote, take control of the algorithms that run your life. Noah Jansiracusa, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Now, look, Noah, I've got to admit, I'm not much of a mathematician or a historian, but I'm pretty sure that Robin Hood wasn't primarily known for his work with formulas. What is the idea of Robin Hood Maths?
Yeah, I mean, the way the book started was I just wanted to help people understand the algorithms that are shaping our lives. Everything you do now, from renting cars to buying plane tickets to shopping, it's all through algorithms. And chatbots, AI, it's just made it even more. So I thought, let me just write a fun explainer where I use a little bit of math to help people see how these things work. But as I dug in, I thought, you know, what I'm kind of doing is taking math from the elites, from the tech companies, from the big government agencies, because they all use math and formulas, and I'm giving it to ordinary people. So it's not exactly taken from the rich and giving to the poor, but it's in that spirit. So it's a nod towards Robin Hood.
Fantastic. Yeah, you just say that you want to present maths in a new and more inclusive life, and you certainly do have tips for how to get yourself better deals and to think through real life problems in a way that benefits from applying mathematical principles. I wonder if you could maybe give us an entry-level example of something you'd describe as Robin Hood math.
Yeah, so one example is college rankings. I'm not sure how much of an industry it is in Australia, but certainly in the UK, in America, everywhere I've been, it's this whole thing. These magazines and newspapers rate universities. Every year a new edition comes out and everyone's jostling for position. It's a big deal. And it's some magic formula that no one really understands. You know, why one school gets 27th place, another gets second place, and what it means. But everyone makes a huge deal of this. And I would say the organizations that are publishing these industries, those are the rich in this example that we're going to steal their math from. Because they're kind of using one formula to tell us what's important, what our values are, what matters to us when we're choosing our university. And it turns out that they just consider a whole bunch of different factors, like what your grades are, grades meaning like the average grades of them with students, graduation rate, financial aid, a whole bunch of things that really make a difference to a lot of people, class sizes. But then the rating agency organization assigns a weight to each of these factors on their own. They might say, oh, this factor is worth twice as much as this other factor. You know, we really care about class size and faculty salaries much more so than retention rates. And that's just an arbitrary decision. And it drives me crazy, to be honest, that they're making this and telling us all how we should feel. Because maybe class sizes matter a lot to me and not so much to my neighbor. Maybe faculty salaries don't matter at all to me. To be honest, they don't. So the Robin Hood math here is I go through in the book explaining that you can actually, and this doesn't take any math. You know, you said you're not really a math person. You are the target for this. You, anyone, can make their own college rankings or any kind of rankings you want. It's very, very simple. The only difference is you get to decide what factors matter and how much they matter rather than some agency that's publishing these things every year telling you. So I think that's an example.
Yeah, I did find that really useful as a way of, I suppose it's a way of structuring what's important to you and giving it a value. And I think one of the themes that comes out from your rankings analysis is that it's more important to trust mathematical processes than merely just numbers that are presented to you. Could you give us another example of how you could apply that in your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because it's almost the exact same example, but credit rating agencies. So in the US, the main one is FICO, but again, every country has their ratings. When you try to get a loan of any kind, they try to see if you're, you know, worthy of credit. And at least the FICO score in the US, but I'm sure there's a similar system in Australia, they give you a number. And what does that number mean? Well, it turns out in a very similar way as the universities, this company or agency has decided these are the factors that matter. How many lines of credit you have, how many late payments you have, this and that. And they put all these factors into a formula where each one is weighted, and then they give you a number. And I just think here we don't have the chance of taking the math in our own hands and make, you know, I can't go to a bank and say, don't worry, I rated my own creditworthiness. But I do think it's frustrating that we all live in a society where these numbers are fixed to us. And most of us, myself included, before I wrote this book, had no idea what these numbers mean. I just saw, oh, I have a credit score. And sometimes I get an email that went up or went down. So I think just knowing that there are these very simple formulas, you know, we're not talking complicated math or AI, very basic, just a sum of numbers, but letting people know that's what's going on and that the are these weights can help you, because then you could see like, oh, it turns out that maybe it's not so surprising, but the most heavily weighted factor in the U.S. system is late payments. So just really focus on that if you want to improve your credit. It's a basic literacy that I think is not entirely lacking, but it's deficient. I think we need to help people realize we are in a world where math is being used in so many of our daily interactions, and yet there's so little effort to help bring us into that conversation and teach us the math and how we can, you know, play the math game as best we can.
We're speaking with Noah John Siracusa, author of Robin Hood Math, Take Control of the Algorithms That Run Your Life. Noah, obviously, weighting is a key concept that you introduce people to and to how to sort of analyze that. What are some of the other core mathematical concepts that you focus on in Robin Hood Math?
Well, this is a little bit funny, I have to admit, because I wanted to talk a little bit about finance, but I'm not a finance person. You know, I've never gone to Wall Street and invested all this. But I just thought, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of investments is, it's kind of, you know, that's mathematical. So let me try to just explain to people some really basic concepts like diversification. I have to admit, again, not as a finance person, I always hear, oh, you should diversify your investment portfolio. And probably me, as in most, you know, non-finance experts, have an intuitive sense. Oh, that means you got to spread out your investments, right? Don't put all your eggs in one basket. But I start to think about it a little bit more. And I thought, you know, there's a really clean, precise way to say what diversification is using math language. It's an average. And just thinking of that, it sounds absolutely trivial. And what profound observation is that? But it turns out it really helped me understand what's going on. Because when you talk about averages, we all have an intuitive sense. Like if I talk about the average height, we all know that it matters if you're talking about the Netherlands, where people tend to be quite tall, or other countries. You know, the population you're averaging matters. So once I started thinking of those terms, I kind of understand what diversification is all about. I can average across the whole stock market, you know, invest in the NASDAQ or something. I could average across an industry. I could average across a few types of stocks. Diversification is just averaging. And there's some math that goes into when an average really does spread things out versus when it doesn't. And I went through this in the book and talked about it. And what surprised me is I've had finance people, even just a couple days ago, someone who is on Wall Street said, I've been tweeting about your book and writing about it in my newsletter, and people are loving it. And it shocked me that this is helpful information. But I have to admit, I think sometimes things get so complicated. And I've seen this in tech industry, in university rankings, and I think in finance too, things get so complicated that even the experts kind of lose the forest for the trees. And sometimes it helps to step back and just say, you know, all we're doing is addition. All we're doing is averaging. All we're doing is weighting. And it helps. So I'm a big fan of simplicity. I think there's a lot of value in it.
Now, one of the thoughts that also stuck with me from your book is your observation that part of being good at math is knowing when not to use it. I wonder if you could explain that a little bit more for us.
Yeah, and that ties into what you asked earlier, and I'm really glad you did, which is this thing that we seem to be more and more affixing numbers to people. And there's a famous book from quite a while ago called Seeing Like a State. And it's kind of this idea that when you have a lot of people that you're managing and dealing with, you can't really see them as individual people, you know, with names and identities. They kind of get blurred into statistics. Well, that's been happening for a long time, but it's happening more. The pace is accelerating, because we have so much technology that helps us do that. We can just plug everyone into big formulas and crunch away. And I think with AI, this is just going to happen at an even faster pace. So I think we're in the situation where we're using numbers very, very heavily. And it's very easy for those numbers to not convey the full story. You know, take, for instance, like a credit score. We're just talking about that. That's a single number that says whether you are worthy of a loan. But there's so much else that might go into your personal background, your story, you know, your life experiences. Whether or not I should launch a new business and whether or not I'll succeed can be based on so many factors. Just to reduce it to a single number that doesn't know anything about me, just knows if I paid my credit card off on time, it's clearly lacking. So we all know that we're in this situation, but I just wanted to be really careful and tell people, don't go overboard. You know, if you just throw numbers at everything, you're going to lose the humanity and lose what numbers don't capture.
And that, I think, gives us a real sense of the breadth of what you cover in Robin Hood Math. It has everything from industry-wide analysis, reflections on the modern tech economy and the like, but also down to really practical things about how to change the way we use big tech services like Amazon and Google. Could you give us a couple of examples of that? How could we better use our Amazon searches?
Yeah, Amazon is an interesting one because there's a lot of layers of depth to it. You can do really basic things that help a lot, or there's more sophisticated. So at a basic level, when you go on Amazon and search for things, they're listed in some order, right? Maybe I'm trying to buy diapers or batteries or whatever it is, and I'll see, oh, the number one choice, the number two choice, number three choice. How often do we really think about what those numbers mean? You know, why is one battery listed number one and another battery listed number 10? Again, it's numbers. It's just like the university rankings, the credit score. It's the same thing. We just see numbers. We take it on faith when we see a number that has a real intrinsic meaning. Well, it turns out that they don't always, or at least they don't always have the meaning that we hope they have. There was some interesting investigative journalism that found Amazon was strongly preferencing their own products on their search rankings. So basically, there's companies, often with a name that has nothing to do with Amazon, so you wouldn't know, selling breakfast cereal or whatever it is. And their product would be placed much higher when you search for cereal than Kellogg's and Famous brands, ones that had higher rankings, more sales, everything. So you start to realize Amazon, they get to rig the game, right? They're selling their own products in a market where they decide which products get most heavily promoted by their algorithm. So they are controlling the levers of that algorithm that decide what rises to the top. So a really simple thing you can do is actually just go up, I think it's in the upper right, you can switch from featured, which is basically let algorithm rank things however they want, to you can sort by number of reviews or ratings. And that way you'll, you know, see the five-star things at the top and you get a more objective view of the products that are out there. So it's very simple, but it's just frustrating because the default is to let Amazon play the game however it wants. And you have to make that extra effort to actually sort by the quality of the product.
Yeah, indeed. And it's true in Australia as well. So many retailers have sorting options, which are probably more consumer friendly, but they're almost uniformly not the default, not the way that the company wants you to look at it. You go into Google a little bit further and say that because of the way Google's developed over the years, it's gone from being a much more useful and reliable free product to something which, to use Cory Doctorow's expression, has been enshittified over the years. What sort of hacks can be used by day-to-day users to try and counteract some of the ways in which Google searching has lost some of its integrity?
Yeah, well, let me zoom out a little bit to kind of explain why that happened, and then we'll go into what you can do about it. The why is, if you think about a service like, I don't know, Netflix, for instance, you subscribe as long as you like the products, and if it stops having good shows, you switch to a different streaming service. It's as simple as that. But Google, you're never paying for it. It's always free. So you don't think in terms of switching. And it became so dominant, you know, it really was synonymous with web search, that you just, no matter how good or bad the search is, once Google convinced the world that it had the best search, everyone just goes on and Googles. And the enshittification is how it slowly just degraded and got worse and worse. But we didn't really think, oh, maybe I should switch to someone else. Maybe I should do something else. And unfortunately, Google is not economically incentivized to produce the best search results for you. They don't get extra money when your search results really are what you're looking for. They get money when you look at ads and click the links that they want you to click. So it's unfortunately this kind of tension of incentives where we go to Google seeking information. Google itself wants to steer us not necessarily away from the information, but towards their advertising and their revenue streams. So once you recognize, like, hey, what I want from Google is not what Google wants to give me. They gave me the product long enough that I got hooked, and now they can just give me ads and there's little I can do about it. So with that in mind, there is not a lot, I would say, as far as like practical tips, but I think just the awareness that you are in this game, that there's a lot of search engine optimization going on, that the rankings are the result of an algorithm that is not in your control. It's in this tech company's control, what their financial incentives are. Just thinking about that big picture, I think, is helpful. And we will see, you know, as people start to get information from other sources like, you know, AI chatbots, maybe Google's going to feel the heat and they'll have to up their game and get back to where they were in the good old days.
Having said all that, I did also find some of your recommendations for how you can refine Google search functions and really focus in on what you want. Really, really practical and helpful. So it shows that there's such a range of information in your book. Noah, perhaps surprisingly, you've also got some reflections in Robin Hood Math about public broadcasting. You're on a public broadcaster, the Australian Public Broadcaster now. Could you tell us how it is that you came from thinking about Robin Hood Maths to opining about public broadcasting?
Yeah, well, it's really because the idea with the Robin Hood Math is I want to take math from the elites, give it to the ordinary people. Or another way to say it is we're in a world that's run by these algorithms, and I want to understand them and help people understand them so they can work with them. And as we said, with things like university rankings, I can do that. I can see the math that they're using and I can explain it to people and they can do their own rankings. But as we talked about with Amazon, with Google, with social media, I can to an extent explain the algorithm, but I can't give you an alternative. I can't change that. So it's a frustrating state of affairs where I want to give the public something and I can't. They have all the power, the tech companies. So that kind of is what leads to this larger question of why have we put so much of our faith and trust in how we all accrue information in a small number of for-profit companies. So if you look at media historically, right, there was radio, you know, long time ago in the 20s, et cetera, and there was public radio, and this was a really nice alternative option. Then there was TV, and there was public TV. But now we're in the age where most people, I hate to say it, get their information from social media. We don't have the ABC, the BBC, the NPR. We don't have that public alternative to TV and radio in the social media age. Everyone is using these for-profit products. And that's, I think, not fantastic. I think we, you know, I'm not against capitalism and against companies. I think offer their services, but I do think we need a public service that has incentives that aren't to steer us away from what we want, that aren't to steer us towards division and arguing and hate speech and incitements to violence, because that builds engagement, which draws lots of ad revenue. I want something where people can just go and get their information and not have all that. So the question is, how do we fund it? How do we get people into it? And you know, there's a whole discussion, but that's the backdrop is, why do we not have a public alternative to social media? And how do we get it?
Indeed. And this is where you come to what I thought was an interesting policy suggestion that you explore in the book, which is a progressive ad tax. Could you tell us what a progressive ad tax is, the rationale for it, and how it would work?
Yeah, a good example to think of before we get to ads is carbon taxes. So this is a very familiar concept. They haven't been implemented much in practice, but I think it's a wonderful idea that you can't just sort of tell people don't pollute. They're going to pollute or emit carbon. You can't ban carbon emissions entirely. We need them, right? We all have to drive our cars and work and everything. What you can do is introduce a financial disincentive, right? Make it more costly if you emit carbon. And that's what a carbon tax does. It says, all right, go ahead and emit your carbon, but you're going to have to pay for it. And then the government that collects that tax money can use that money to do things like carbon capture technology and reforestation to fight climate change, the issue that we're addressing. So Paul Romer is a Nobel Prize winning economist, and he had the idea of doing something similar or trying to do something similar with our whole online ecosystem with ads specifically, which is there are many people who argue one of the main problems, some people even call it the original sin of the internet, is that almost everything is funded through ads. As I mentioned, like Netflix, you pay for the service, you choose to do it. And what's amazing about Netflix is I could watch one show a week, I could watch 10 hours a day. Doesn't matter. If I like what I'm paying for, I keep going. But all these free services like TikTok, they make more money if I spend more time on it. So TikTok engineers their algorithm to be as addictive as possible. If we paid a monthly fee for TikTok, that wouldn't be the case. They would just say, oh, as long as you're happy coming back each month, we're happy. But because we're using ads, everything is designed for maximum minutes spent, maximum addiction. And I think that's where a lot of the unhealthy aspects of the internet are coming in, that addiction aspect. So the idea with an ad tax is to try to think sort of like carbon tax. Let's say, look, you can go ahead and use advertising as your revenue stream. We're not going to ban that, but let's make you pay for it. So the more money you collect through targeted advertising, as companies like Google and Meta and TikTok do, the more they have to pay taxes, which might make them consider alternatives like subscription fees. Plus, that money that we get from the ad tax can fund things like a public alternative to social media. So I think it all comes together nicely. I think we should try it, but you know, it's hard to pass a new tax.
Indeed, indeed. Whether it's a carbon tax or a ad tax, yeah, they can be hard to get through legislatures, but it's still a fascinating idea well explored in Robin Hood Math. Noah, it's been great speaking with you. Just before we go, I did notice that you dedicated your latest book to a Mr. J. Morrow. Not me, I was relieved to learn, but I wonder if you could briefly tell us why that name is in your dedication.
Yeah, that's, I didn't even think of the name coincidence, but you're absolutely right. So this is James Morrow. He was the first math professor I had in university. He just had such a passion for math, like one of these people that just, math was his world. He lives in numbers and formulas. I don't think I'm a person like that, for better or worse. I'm not one of these like math prodigies where everything is numbers. I'm more of a normal person who just kind of enjoys using math. But his passion for math was so contagious that it just really drew me into the subject. And he was one of these formative teachers you have in your youth that, you know, the profession you end up in is so largely because of that one teacher. So he was that one teacher. Unfortunately, he passed away just a year ago. So I thought, I was so happy to send him a copy of the book when I finished it and didn't have that chance. So I thought, let me at least dedicate it to him.
Oh, and on that lovely note, we'll say thank you, Noah John Siracusa.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Noah's Associate Professor in Mathematical Sciences at Bentley University, and his latest book is Robin Hood Math, Take Control of the Algorithms That Run Your Life.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.